Lodge, 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. At a peace conference in Switzerland, 80 countries calling for the territorial integrity of Ukraine as any basis, they say, for a peace deal to end Russia's two-year war. Back in the U.S., GOP Representative Michael McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, expressing growing concern, he says, over the war in Ukraine and Gaza and brewing global conflicts. McCaul spoke with ABC affiliate WFAA in Dallas about the dangers.
People forget that we're in a world war on the cusp of dictatorship and tyranny taking over.
McCaul says the biggest competitor for the U.S. remains China when it comes to tech and AI. Police in Texas say a shooting at a Juneteenth celebration in Round Rock appears to be due to a dispute. Two innocent bystanders were killed, six others injured. It's one of a handful of shootings this weekend across the country. And in Saudi Arabia, Syrian heat being blamed for the deaths of 14 Jordanians at Mecca. This is ABC News. The UN praising Israel's new mini pauses in fighting to help boost aid into Gaza and also ensure safe distribution.
The Israeli army halting all military activities along a key road in southern Gaza to increase the flow of humanitarian aid. The IDF announcing it will hold its fire from 7 a.m. local time to 8 p.m., 11 hours each day until further notice on a six-mile stretch of Salah al-Din Road. The limited pause in fighting comes as the UN warns hunger, malnutrition, and disease are spreading in central Gaza following the IDF's closure of the Rafah crossing in May. Jordana Miller, ABC News, Jerusalem.
Israelis are also burying their dead today after that deadly Hamas ambush that left a group of eight soldiers dead. Extreme weather delivering a double punch to parts of China. Heavy rain and flooding forcing the evacuation of people in the south, and a heat wave prompting fears of drought for farmers in the north. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Could there be a better name? Auto Value Parts Stores. They aren't just about air fresheners or fuzzy dice. Auto Value Parts Stores are all about parts, auto parts, and advice. Pros who know auto parts with tons of tips when you need them the most. You want real value? Don't go to a place with a cute name. Go to Auto Value. Could there be a better name? I didn't think so. Your Auto Value Parts Store. We've got the parts. We've got the smarts.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Matt Mayer on air.
I've never played this game. Uno is great because kids can play against adults without being overmatched, and adults can play it together and still have fun.
Robert from McFarland flipped a table during an Uno game.
Maybe this is why I don't play these games.
Oh, I would love to play Uno with you.
You want to have an Uno fest?
Yeah, that would be awesome.
We could, like, have an Uno Fest for charity or something.
That'd be cool.
Matt and Air on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. A new report shows Wisconsin does a great job providing resources to keep some kids happy and healthy. However, white kids are benefiting the most, while research shows the Badger State is the worst in the nation for black families. Mike Moen reports.
An annual report suggests Wisconsin has a strong foundation in creating positive outcomes for kids. But low test scores and racial disparities show not all youth are faring well. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's latest Kids Count data book ranks Wisconsin 11th in the country for child well-being. The state saw a slight dip in its child poverty rate, falling to 13%. However, Emily Mayota of the statewide policy group Kids Forward says the positive results mask persistent disparities for the Badger State.
Wisconsin remains the worst state in the nation for black children and families.
For example, black children were 29 times more likely to live in high poverty areas than white children. Those disparities also spill over into education. The report contends the pandemic is not solely to blame for the country's worsening educational outcomes. The Casey Foundation's Leslie Bossier says educators, researchers, policymakers, and employers who track students' academic readiness have been ringing alarm bells for a long time.
The pandemic erased decades of increases in math scores. However, if you look over the 35 years that we've produced the data book, we've never seen a significant percentage of children who were either proficient in fourth grade reading or basic math.
The report calls on all states to expand access to intensive tutoring for students who are behind in their classes and missing academic milestones. Wisconsin did see a worsening rate of young children not attending school. This is Mike Mowen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some chances for showers and thunderstorms across the area for your Father's Day. We'll see high temperatures warming to the middle and upper 80s, south winds on the breezy side. In the overnight, more showers and thunderstorms. Our lows will drop to the lower 60s. Right now, it's 73.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday on Up North News Radio, Megan Rowe from Opportunity Wisconsin talks about their work to remind voters of candidates' real records, not just their rhetoric.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. This, the second hour of our weekend, our weekly review of justice-related issues in America and beyond. Thank you so much for joining me in this, our second hour, reviewing this weekend all things related to the United States Supreme Court, beginning to issue these major opinions that are going to define the 2023-2024 term, and indeed, they have already done exactly that. Also taking your phone calls, as always, your questions and your inquiries in particular, that phone number 844-967-2789, and also much inviting your comments and your questions in particular. Drop us a note. Drop a note to Max and me, and let us know what you're thinking on the Civic Media app. All of that, inviting your participation in your involvement here, your discussion of these major Supreme Court cases. We have talked already about this very significant case in which the Supreme Court ruled that a Trump-era, a binary-era ban on gun bump stocks cannot stand. It is a diminution of the capacity of this agency to do what it's assigned to do. And it is also a guns case because undeniably it relates to safety and security in America. That case coming out just this past week, another case now talking about here on our broadcast, and that involves this abortion pill, mifepristone. We know that this case comes up from a lower court. Recall well, as we have discussed on this very broadcast, the genesis of this particular case, a federal judge, his name is Matthew Kaczmarek, had said that based upon his review of this situation, that the FDA's approval of this drug over a period of about a quarter century or so has to be suspended, has to be stopped, because mifepristone, based upon his analysis, is not in fact safe to be on the market. Judge Kaczmarek joined the federal bench for what this is worth after years of litigating for a conservative religious freedom firm on appeal from that decision, basically tossing out what the experts were saying inside the FDA, what the FDA itself had determined after a quarter century of review and analysis, telling the medical community, telling America that this particular drug is indeed safe and able, accessible for proper use in accomplishing abortions in America. Appeals court in New Orleans, this is again, the higher court beyond Judge Kaczmarek's court, overturned a part of that decision that invalidated the FDA's approval of that pill, but it imposed certain other restrictions on its distribution. And it's basically those restrictions that included things like prohibiting the pill from being sent by the mail or prescribed by telemedicine accounts. That's the context in which this came up to the United States Supreme Court. That's a bit more detail than the media generally is telling you about. The big ticket items, the big headline, of course, here is that the Supreme Court unanimously says, we've got the wrong plaintiffs. You do not have standing here. And in answer to the question that Justice Antonin Scalia posed many, many years ago, what's it to you? How have you been damaged? The Supreme Court says these associations and these doctors cannot show it. It is not enough to propose and speculate about a future harm that they may suffer. That is not it. Justice Kavanaugh writing again for the majority, the plaintiffs must show a predictable chain of events leading from the government action to the asserted injury. In this instance, he writes, the doctors and medical associations trying to challenge that regulation simply failed to show any actual injury. Why? Because they didn't include people actually involved with the pill, like doctors who prescribed mifepristone or pregnant women who took it. And again, as we are describing here on our weekend broadcast, plainly opening up the door, keeping open the possibility, if you've got the right plaintiffs, the Supreme Court may, in fact, address this on the substantive basis, not doing that. Not doing that. A colleague of mine said they punted on this issue. They did, in fact, accomplish the good result of keeping this safe drug in our capacity to provide for pregnant women through their doctors, through their medical providers. But it kept open the door for a future attack on the FDA. What is the analysis? What is the commonplace understanding of what the Supreme Court is doing here? Why did it seize on this standing issue? Well, very clear from the oral argument that the Supreme Court members, all of them, none of them were interested in overturning the capacity, rejecting the capacity of the FDA to act generally. Why? Because of the broad breadth of the FDA's responsibility with respect to many other drugs that are out there. You begin to carve away the capacity here, you may in fact implicate the capacity of the agency to do this in other areas. Not willing to do that, none of them willing to do that, and yet the conservatives on the bench not willing to come forward and say that mifepristone is okay because of that, of course, is an abortion issue. So, and perhaps it's a compromise here. The upshot is this case goes off on standing, as cases sometimes do. And answering Justice Scalia's question, Justice Kavanaugh's question, what's it to you? Apparently for these doctors and the associations, there's nothing. There's nothing there. Although, once again, the possibility of this case returning to the Supreme Court or another tribunal, that is entirely possible down the road. Those two cases, big cases coming out of the Supreme Court, having to do with firearms, having to do with mifepristone and privacy rights, and also having to do on a broad scope analysis with the capacity of our agencies to do what they're assigned to do. In one case saying, nope, ATF cannot do this. In the other, arguably, sort of the back door saying that the FDA can do this, but not really addressing the issue. Coming to that result only because we've got the wrong petitioners, the wrong plaintiffs in here, the case now over. As always, we invite your calls, your comments, your inquiries here, 844-967-2789. And we do have a caller on the line. Always appreciate that. Mark, calling into our broadcast this weekend, appreciate your comment or your question.
Yeah, I'm particularly disturbed by the whole fire bump stock thing because functionally it moves, you know, simply because we're able to make this wheelie decision simply because they moved the mechanism back into the stock rather than to the receiver, where it happens in the typical machine gun, or, you know, that you can turn it to automatic auto fire. That is what it seems like to me, because if you maintain a certain, I don't know how they work, but if you manage a certain pressure, it turns them functionally into a machine gun. 1,000 rounds per minute is a machine gun.
It sounds, Marcus, if you know what you're talking. You're a gun owner yourself, is that right?
That's right. I mean, I've disassembled firearms, you know, when I was a kid. That I actually can remember back when I was a younger person back in the early 1970s. I had a book called The Firearms Encyclopedia, described the assault type weapon as something good for military style target for military use, but not really any good for, you know, hunting purposes at all. And that's the way it was looked at back in that point in time. Because this is simply, you know, that. And I can remember back when I was a kid, they had, you know, you could convert a couple of Ruger 10-22s into a Gatling gun, you know, where you were turning a crank. And if you look back, a Gatling gun was described as the first machine gun. And in that case, you turned a crank, which, you know, rapidly pulled the trigger. But in this case right here, it's simply a matter of you're moving the fully automatic thing from the receiver into the stock. And that's what it seems like to me. And that's the argument I would make. But these guys wanted to make these things legal to appease a part of their portion of their base. And it is just that case in Las Vegas where all those
right.
800 people got wounded. I mean, in addition to the 60 people being killed. I mean, it would just be so simple.
It's catastrophic, right? I mean, absolutely. And Mark, your analysis, that is, very much appreciate your call and your expertise here. That's exactly what the Supreme Court on the left and on the right were arguing about, right? Exactly. How does this work? What do bum stocks do? And again, Sonia Sotomayor and the others saying you've just got it wrong. I take it you would be on the side of the Sonia Sotomayors out there who say that the Supreme Court, in its analysis, Justice Thomas has these specific diagrams, which I suspect probably are derivative from the encyclopedia that you're talking about. He is trying to explain why it is under the technical understanding of what's going on here. These diagrams indicating that they've got no choice but to find that this regulation prohibiting bump stocks has got to fall. And so, Mark, very much appreciate your comment, your insight as a gun owner, plainly indicating that this particular ruling not supported even by your own application, your own understanding of firearms as you have used them. Mark, as always, appreciate your involvement in our broadcast. Moving on, then, there are other cases, believe it or not, six of them all together that the Supreme Court has issued just on Thursday and Friday of this past week. Six cases altogether that are out there. Supreme Court has also issued some cases in the area of labor and intellectual property. We're going to spend some time talking about those as well. And again, also taking your phone calls, your questions, and your comments along the way. The Supreme Court, again, on Thursday, was a busy day on Thursday, ruled in favor of a company that I suspect many of you know, probably even patronize, called Starbucks. Ruling in favor of Starbucks on Thursday, this was a challenge against a labor ruling by a federal judge. The upshot of the ruling makes it more difficult for this key federal agency called the National Labor Relations Board, yet another agency, another focus of the Supreme Court here, making it more difficult for that agency to intervene when a company, in this case Starbucks, is accused of illegally suppressing labor organizing. That's why this is a labor case and involving, once again, the NLRB, making it more difficult to order employers to reinstate fired workers. Now, how does this come about? What did the Supreme Court say in connection with this particular case, an agency case and a lawyer case both? Eight justices backed the majority opinion, which was, again, written by Clarence Thomas. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, she also writes a separate opinion. She's concurring in the result with the overall judgment here, but she dissents on certain points along the way. How does this case come to the Supreme Court? Here it is. The ruling came in a case that was brought by Starbucks over the firing of about seven workers in Memphis. They were trying to unionize there at a store in 2022. You probably saw some reporting on this. The company, Starbucks, at that time said it had fired them for allowing a television crew into a closed store. And so at the time, the workers, who called themselves the Memphis Seven, said that they were fired for their unionization efforts and that the company at that time didn't typically enforce the rules they were accused of violating at the time. So we've got a difference of opinion here about exactly what is the genesis of the termination of these workers. After those firings by Starbucks, the National Labor Relations Board, that is this federal agency, issues a complaint. And we're going to talk more about what that complaint says on behalf of the workers, the response by Starbucks, and what the result is below and what the impact of this blow to the NLRB authority has coming out of the Supreme Court decision also issued just on Thursday of this past week. Stay with us for more of discussion here on Amicus.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true.
In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, with you in this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking all things Supreme Court this weekend, because indeed, the Supreme Court is doing a lot of things that are impacting us in America and generations to come based upon the kinds of decisions it's making and the nature of the rulings that it is issuing right now. One of those, again, a labor case, also an agency case with respect to something called the National Labor Relations Board. You probably know it as the NLRB. This case coming out of Starbucks, once again, fires 7 workers in Memphis. They were trying to unionize at the time. The company says, we did that because they allowed a television crew into a closed store at the time. The workers come back and say, nope. They call themselves the Memphis 7. And they say that they were fired because they were attempting to unionize there. And that's the basis. That's the termination basis from Starbucks. A basic difference in the reasons for the termination. That's important because of what happens in the wake of what the Supreme Court does here. The Supreme Court establishes standards here for future reviews of these kinds of things. We've talked a lot about that on this broadcast, articulating the principles, the touchstones, the kinds of things that courts below should be looking at in determining whether or not there is indeed a violation of the labor laws. In this case, after conducting an investigation, which is what the NLRB does, they issued a complaint basically on behalf of the workers, saying that Starbucks had in fact acted inappropriately because the workers had joined or assisted the union and engaged in what the NLRB called concerted activities. And to discourage employees from engaging in those specific activities. That was in the complaint that was filed on behalf of the workers by this agency, the NLRB. Separately, lawyers for the board had asked a federal judge in Tennessee for an injunction, a restraint, if you will, reinstating the workers, and the judge issued the order in August of 2022. Now, the agency asked the judges to reinstate those workers in such cases because resolving the underlying issue, the legal issues there, could take years, during which time the workers might, in fact, become discouraged from organizing, even if the fired workers ultimately prevail. In other words, there's a timing issue here, and that's the reason why the NLRB wanted to go forward and get this before the courts and get some resolution of it. So they file then this case. It goes to the Supreme Court. The company arguing before the Supreme Court, again in an oral argument, arguing that the federal courts had differing standards, different kinds of touchstones, different principles and thresholds when deciding whether to grant injunctions that reinstate workers. So that's the procedural status of all of this. The NLRB has the authority, of course, to seek these kinds of remedies under something called the National Labor Relations Act. They invoke that. They talk about the injunction standards, and they note that some courts apply a looser standard that requires the board to show that there was a reasonable cause to believe that the company had violated the labor law. Other courts out there use a stricter standard requiring that the board, the NLRB, show that not reinstating the workers would cause some irreparable harm and that the board was likely to prevail in the case in any event. Other cases involving the same kinds of things, other courts have actually combined elements of these two standards. Now, Starbucks had argued that the stricter standard for reinstating its workers should apply nationwide, And the Labor Board, of course, on the opposite side, argued that the apparent differences between the two standards was, here's this word once again, semantic, word-related, that it's not really practical, it's just about language, and that effectively these are one standards in place already, and that the Supreme Court doesn't have to intervene to review any of this as at all. So in the wake of all of that, and yes, it's a lot that lawyers love to talk about, the majority opinion in trying to resolve all of this related to injunctions and the rule of the NLRB and the kinds of things that it does and does not do, these standards involved in this case, the majority opinion rejects the board's argument and that the differences between the two standards are really just semantic, nothing much to see here. The Supreme Court says, nope, that's not the case. Majority writing this, the reasonable cause standard goes far beyond simple fine-tuning the traditional criteria. It substantively lowers the bar for securing a preliminary injunction. The majority opinion, the Supreme Court opinion, points out that in cases where other laws allow judges to issue these kinds of preliminary injunctions, the stricter standard is usually applied, concluding then that nothing in the labor laws here in this particular case suggests that the courts should deviate from that when it comes to reinstating workers. In other words, looking at other situations, nothing different here to see. Now, it's significant, of course, this comes up during the course of the presentation of this case to the Supreme Court. About 400 Starbucks stores representing over 10,000 workers in the United States have unionized since 2021. And the two sides actually began holding some nationwide talks on a contract framework in April. You probably heard about that in the news. Starbucks owns and operates about 10,000 stores across the country. And again, based upon the oral argument that we saw back in April, it appeared likely that the Supreme Court would be siding with Starbucks, which in fact they have done. Conservative justices at that time kind of questioning what the NLRB was doing here, why they needed this looser standard that applied to other agencies. And the decision, significantly, because once again it's establishing standards, did not specifically decide in favor of Starbucks substantively. No exact decision about what happened here, whether these employees were in fact the victims, if you will, of inappropriate labor terminations or if there was something else going on here. Instead, what the Supreme Court says is we're siding with the company Starbucks in its articulation of the standard, and we're sending all this back down to the lower court, remanding it, of course, is the word, for the court below to apply these standards, the standards that Starbucks wants, when it comes to this kind of injunctive relief. And of course, based upon my own past history, many legal experts out there noting that this injunctive capacity of the NLRB to engage in these kinds of things, a very effective tool to ensure that our labor laws are supported, stopping companies from illegally suppressing union activities, unionizing activities. And that kind of thing is important, right, for our nation to ensure that labor laws are enforced, that under appropriate circumstances when labor forces want to unionize, the good things that come from unions, that's the commission of the NLRB, to protect the capacity of employees when they want to do so to unionize. If, in fact, you go in the other direction, discouraging companies from firing workers, that's the purpose of these kinds of injunctive activities that the NLRB often engages in. Now, significantly, the numbers of these are not that great. Just this past year, only about 20 injunctions sought by the NLRB. So this is a significant and important practice, but not that commonplace. But they do, in fact, serve this powerful, what's called a deterrent, right, against firing workers who are trying to unionize. And that's why this case is so very important. Now, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, again, concurring with the majority, nonetheless says that the board should have to demonstrate irreparable harm if the workers were not reinstated, and that it was likely to prevail in the merits anyway. She argued that those were relatively easy standards to apply, easy to show, she says, in cases in which the board sought injunctive relief. She argues, for example, in, again, her concurring, that's just sort of an amending opinion here. She says that irreparable harm was almost trivial to prove because labor violations typically take years to adjudicate. If a worker is fired, she says, no possibility for resolution for several years. This irreparably harms the board's ability to remedy the situation the relief will come too late. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson adding her own perspective to the decision on labor coming out of the United States Supreme Court just this past week. More from the Supreme Court as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. At a peace conference in Switzerland, 80 countries calling for the territorial integrity of Ukraine as any basis, they say, for a peace deal to end Russia's two-year war. Back in the U.S., GOP Representative Michael McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, expressing growing concern, he says, over the war in Ukraine and Gaza and brewing global conflicts. McCaul spoke with ABC affiliate WFAA in Dallas about the dangers.
People forget that we're in a world war on the cusp of dictatorship and tyranny taking over.
McCaul says the biggest competitor for the U.S. remains China when it comes to tech and AI. Police in Texas say a shooting at a Juneteenth celebration in Round Rock appears to be due to a dispute. Two innocent bystanders were killed, six others injured. It's one of a handful of shootings this weekend across the country. And in Saudi Arabia, Syrian heat being blamed for the deaths of 14 Jordanians at Mecca. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The state championships are over. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Girls High School Soccer State Championships at Eline Park in Milwaukee. Division 3 Plymouth beat Catholic Memorial 2-1. Division 2 Oregon shut out Whitefish Bay 1-0. And for the third year in a row, Muskego won the state title by beating Kimberly 2-1 in Division 1. Baseball, Brewers and the Reds wrapping up their series. A full recap later tonight. Last night, the crew won 3-1 thanks to a Joey Ortiz 3-run homer in the fifth, manager Pat Murphy.
That big moment for him as a young player gives everybody a lift. I mean, I think it's safe to say, guys, we're not playing as that scrappy underdog team.
And rapper Snoop Dogg, with a concert in Milwaukee, stopped by the press box to do some play-by-play on Valley Sports Wisconsin.
Sanchez on the 1-2. What I told you, get it in there. Oh, he in there. That's Sanchez. That's yes, I told you, baby. We call that an easy walk in the park. That's a base hit. Give him a single. He does like to mingle. And my favorite jingle is the S to the N, double O, no, no.
That's Snoop Dogg with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some chances for showers and thunderstorms across the area for your Father's Day. We'll see high temperatures warming to the middle and upper 80s. South winds on the breezy side. In the overnight, more showers and thunderstorms. Our lows will drop to the lower 60s. Right now, it's 73.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Water World, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
Are you and your family weather ready? I'm Terry Barr. Wisconsin weather is ever-changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our Weather Ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
Consider yourself a snowbird with property in the south, or just like to vacation there. You'll want to keep an eye on what's predicted to be an active hurricane season from now through the end of November. Forecasters say that there's an 85% chance of above the normal number of hurricanes, especially in the Atlantic Basin. Here's what it could look like. 17 to 25 storms, 8 to 13 of them becoming hurricanes, and 4 to 7 of those could be major. If you're wondering why, temperatures in the Atlantic Ocean are near record warmth, and La Niña conditions are developing, and both of these support the formation of tropical storms. No matter where you go, it's information to keep you and your family weather ready. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Brian, do you buy your tickets on Ticketmaster?
Whether I want to or not, I do.
Bella Devan. We're going to talk a little bit about monopolies.
Live Nation and Ticketmaster together control 80% of the primary ticketing market. They have the market power to bully people into submission. And then you trap consumers into basically having to pay like junk fees that are basically created to create profit for the company.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music critic Piet Levy, who joins the show to discuss all things Summerfest. We will also discuss the resurgence of the summer box office.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, as we continue this in our weekend review of the major decisions coming out of the highest court in the land, the United States Supreme Court. Nine justices on our Supreme Court, sometimes agreeing unanimously, often not agreeing at all. Talking about all of these cases on a 62-case docket, many of those cases now being issued here in June, probably into July as well. Lots of activity going on there. We are talking this morning and have spoken a lot about some of these major issues. Talking about this Starbucks case involving labor and the agency NLRB, the standards it applies in seeking injunctive relief to vindicate the rights, at least temporarily, of employees in America. Talking also about this major case involving bump stocks and guns, the authority of the ATF, another agency to administer its laws and its regulations in a way that keeps us safe and secure, finding that bump stocks are in fact legal and that the ATF has no authority to restrict their use, their sale, and so forth. And in another case, of course, also having to do with things on the docket of America, this major case involving abortion, mifepristone, finding on a standing basis, not a substantive basis, but a standing basis, that this case needs to be dismissed, leaving open the possibility that the drug itself may be the subject of a future attack down the road. Other cases out there of all sorts of varieties, as we talked at the top of the first hour on our weekend broadcast, those are coming up as well. And undeniably, in the weeks just ahead, the Supreme Court is going to ramp up the speed, the ferocity, if you will, with which it's going to be issuing these opinions. We'll be covering all of that and focusing on doing these kinds of deep analyses of what's really going on here, talking about what the justices themselves say, what they don't say, what's really happening here, trying to understand what these cases are all about. Now, there is yet another case that is important. It's in the area of intellectual property. It involves, believe it or not, the former President Donald Trump. And there are an awful lot of people look at this particular case in a light of levity. And indeed, there's a certain aspect of it, which we will get to, that is much lighter than these other issues related to labor and abortion and guns. But we're necessarily going to focus on it, even though its issue is a little bit lighter. Also lightens the overall discussion here on our weekend broadcast. Again, on Thursday, among the three cases issued by the Supreme Court, in addition to the abortion mifepristone case, the labor case involving Starbucks, another case involving trademark protections, intellectual property, the Supreme Court on Thursday rejecting a request by a California, yes, that's right, a lawyer, who is attempting to trademark the phrase Trump too small. That's the phrase, Trump too small. Keep that in mind. We'll get back to that. The decision, unanimous, 9-0. However, the other reason why this particular disposition is so instructive and insightful is you've got this very, very fractured decision-making process where justices are arguing among each other about the bases upon which to come to the conclusion that this California lawyer does not have a right to trademark this phrase, Trump too small. They all agree with the result, but they attack each other. They go back and forth, all sorts of concurring opinions that are very difficult to parse out. We'll try to do a little bit of that for you right now. Justice is basically fundamentally arguing once again about history. We know from a lot of the analysis that we have done on this broadcast that this particular Supreme Court, or at least its conservative majority, most often when it comes to some of these big ticket items, including things like guns, does what? Requires that you look backwards. You look to history, right? You've got to try to find under Bruin, which is this pending principled case out of the Supreme Court, establishing principles for understanding and assessing the legislation of various localities and counties and states before you can approve of a restriction or condition on the sale or use or manufacture of firearms. You got to find an historic antecedent to that. Something in the past has got to give you a basis for deciding today in the 21st century that this particular restriction can in fact be imposed. The Rahimi case in that area, the other one that's not yet resolved, this domestic violence case, is a case that's going to test Bruin wildly, determining whether or not a restriction on someone who's got a domestic violence restraining order against him, if the federal law prohibiting that person from owning and using a weapon can stand. Do you look back in history to figure out whether that's legitimate? A history that probably does not have a lot of long-term history when it comes to domestic violence. That's a concept that's relatively new in our jurisprudence. That issue is going to loom large in that Rahimi case. It comes back here, the question of history and the reliance that you make on history in determining things today. It surfaces again here in this trademark case involving the proposal, the request to trademark the phrase Trump too small. How does it come about? Well, let's go back and talk once again about the specific bases for this case. It concerns a federal law that prohibits the registration of trademarks that identify a particular, and here's the important word, living individual, except by his or her written consent. In other words, if you're trying to trademark, you're trying to establish an intellectual property right in a phrase that includes a specific proper name, for example, Trump, you can't do it. The federal law basically prohibits that. And in this case, of course, this California lawyer is seeking to trademark the phrase Trump too small. Now, plainly, Donald Trump is still very much alive. He's running for the presidency, as we all know. And so it seems that this particular rule of the Patent and Trademark Office, there's another agency of the federal system. Once again, agencies looming large in all these cases. That particular rule of the Patent and Trademark Office would seem to preclude the registration, the trademark establishment for this particular phrase. And indeed it does. And here is the rub. Justice Thomas, writing for five justices, although they all concur in the end and the result, he says this: we hold only that, here we go, history and tradition establish that the particular restriction before us does not violate the First Amendment. Again, we're looking to the past, history and tradition. Now, raising that very issue, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, again, in a concurring opinion, everybody agrees this particular phrase should not be trademarked. She nonetheless goes on and says, I disagree with the way in which you get there. She says, in places that basically sort of read like a dissent, it is very vigorous. She's very critical of what she calls the indeterminacy of the court's history and tradition inquiry, which one might aptly describe as the equivalent. And listen to this. This is from Sonia Sotomayor criticizing Justice Thomas and the others for this dependency upon history and tradition. She says you might describe that as the equivalent of entering a crowded cocktail party and looking over everyone's heads to find your friends. Entering a cocktail party, looking over everyone's heads to find your friends. We're going to try to find something out there that supports our result. To make matters worse, she went on, again, this is an opinion, the five-justice majority that undertakes this tradition as dispositive inquiry found its friends in a crowded party to which it was not invited. The analogy continues. That majority has drawn conclusive inferences from its historical evidence, all without any guidance from the litigants or the court below. That is in the so-called concurrence, sounding an awful lot like a dissent, right? Now, how does this case come about? The trademark application itself comes from a lawyer. His name is Steve Elster, and his name is part of the case now. He said he wanted to convey the message that's, according to him, that some features of President Trump and his policies are diminutive. They're small. That's what he said in his application to the Patent and Trademark Office. That's part of his request to trademark this phrase. He said he'd use the phrase on T-shirts with a list of Mr. Trump's positions on the back. For instance, he says, small on civil rights. Now, there's plainly something else going on here. We all know what it is, and we'll do a little bit of history on this as well. Justice Thomas, in his majority opinion, sort of notes implicitly, kind of dryly, that the basis for the reference is out there. We all know what it is. He says the mark draws on an exchange between then-candidate Donald Trump and Senator Marco Rubio. Way back in 2016, this was a primary presidential debate, you may recall it. During the course of that, what Mr. Rubio, who is a Republican in Florida, the senator there, said was that Donald Trump had small hands, and went on to say, you know what they say about guys with small hands. During a presidential debate then, Trump addressed Rubio's critique. He says this, he says, look at those hands. Are those small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee. Now, none of that shows up in the Supreme Court opinion, thankfully, but it underscores once again the level of the discourse in at least that presidential debate. We're talking about hands and other things. And that event is what ultimately gives rise to this opinion having to do with the trademarking, the attempt to trademark this phrase. So the justices give a nod to the notion that there's an unspoken and understated predicate for all of this. The Patent and Trademark Office rejected Mr. Elster's application, however, not on the basis that it has this sort of dark, if you will, or even tongue-in-cheek implication there based upon this back-and-forth exchange between Rubio and Trump about the size of hands during the 2016 debate. They're not focusing upon that, but rather they determine whether or not the particular phrase uses the name of a living person, and of course it does. The unanimous three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit ruled that the First Amendment, from which this decision comes up to the Supreme Court, required the office to allow the registration. So the lower court says, yes, you got to do this. The government at that lower level has no valid publicity interest that could overcome the First Amendment protections afforded to the political criticism embodied in Elster's mark. Again, the lower court embracing the political aspect of this and not the debate aspect of it. This, again, the lower court, as a result of the president's status as a public official, and because this attorney Elster's mark, communicates his disagreement with and criticism of the then president's approach to governance, the government has no interest in disadvantaging Elster's speech. And as a result of that, the lower court, this is a judge named Timothy D.Y.K. Dyke, he says that the First Amendment requires that the agency grant this trademark. In earlier cases, the Supreme Court has ruled that other provisions of the trademark law also run afoul of the First Amendment. But those cases, Justice Thomas wrote, in this case, involve discrimination based on viewpoint. So he distinguishes those other cases, including the case that Judge Dyke below had invoked to find that the trademark should be granted. He says that in 2019, for instance, it rejected a provision barring the registration of immoral or scandalous trademarks. That case, interestingly, once again, all of these, some language here that, again, ends up in the federal reporters here about the Supreme Court. That particular case, 2019, in which this case plainly comes in the wake, that 2019 case concerns a line of clothing. It is sold and distributed under a brand name, all capital letters, F-U-C-T. And when the case was argued, a government lawyer, much like this one as well, told the justices the term, this was the language of the lawyer, the term is the equivalent of the past participle form of the paradigmatic profane word in our culture. And at that time, Justice Kagan, writing for a 6-justice majority, did not dispute that, did not get into the underlying sort of back and forth about this language itself. But she said that the law was unconstitutional because it disfavors certain ideas, once again promoting this idea of First Amendment rights. And a bedrock principle of First Amendment law, she wrote at that time, is that the government may not draw distinctions based upon a speaker's viewpoints. All of that came up again in this Elster case, and we're going to talk more about that as we continue our review of this case on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Max Inc. Radio.
He can play it all, and we'll challenge Graham Marlowe to it when he's in studio for a live Saturday night concert. I'm Terry Barr. Join me, Rocker, and Jimmy King.
Weekend evenings on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. Jim Santel, your host for the remaining time we have together on this weekend broadcast, talking about this case involving intellectual property and whether or not this attorney coming out of California can indeed get a trademark for the phrase Trump too small. The Supreme Court unanimously coming to the conclusion that no, indeed, the Federal Patent and Trademark Office does not have to grant that trademark based upon the fact that Trump is alive, he's a real live person, and that's the standard that's applied by the agency. But along the way, as some argument about whether or not this restricts First Amendment rights, the lower court, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, rules that indeed the First Amendment does require that the office allow this registration. That position rejected by the Supreme Court once this case comes up. And indeed, along the way, a lot of these cases do involve the specific language and their understanding in the public domain. We're talking a lot about the cases of the past upon which the Supreme Court has relied in both supporting its finding here, but also distinguishing them. And indeed, Justice Thomas here writes that the Supreme Court cases involving First Amendment, including those upon which the lower court relied, those are not applicable here. This case, the challenge provision here, applies to both positive and negative references to living individuals, does not discriminate based upon viewpoint. This is not a First Amendment case, the justice writes. However, of course, that was not the end of the matter. Going forward, the other justices in this case respond. Justice Sotomayor, joined by Justices Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, again, noting across sort of the partisan chasm, if you will, in the Supreme Court, agreed that the provision was constitutional, but they said the majority's rationale was alarming, and they engage in an attack on what Justice Thomas was saying. This court, Justice Sotomayor wrote, has never applied this kind of history and tradition test to a free speech challenge. The test, she said, was borrowed from the court's 2022 decision in Bruin, and that's exactly what we've talked about here. She goes on to say the majority attempts to reassure litigants and the lower courts that a history-focused approach is sensible and workable. Sotomayor goes on to say that in the aftermath of the Bruin decision demonstrates that this look back, this look to history, this new methodology is wildly misguided. One need only read a handful of lower court decisions applying Bruin to appreciate the confusion this court has caused. So what happens here is inside this intellectual property decision that has to do with this sort of silly phrase used by this attorney. And, oh, by the way, he can continue to use it. He simply can't get it trademarked. And that's the important point going forward. He can continue to use it on whatever he wants to do out there. There's no, not restricting his First Amendment rights, but here, these other Supreme Court justices, including Ketanji Brown Jackson and others, report that this history reference, they report it in their own opinions, their concurrences, this reliance on history that the Supreme Court continues to advocate for is simply wrong, and it produces bad results. And inside this intellectual property case, she invokes this gun analysis, which again underscores the difficulty of doing a past history. Interestingly, this history and tradition focus that the majority and Justice Thomas advocate for doesn't sit well with Amy Coney Barrett either. Here's what she says, her concurrence at length, it's worth reviewing. She says the court claims that history and tradition settle the constitutionality of the names clause. That's the reference to this particular rule, rendering it unnecessary to adopt a standard for gauging whether a content-based trademark restriction abridges the right to free speech. She says that is wrong twice over. That's what she writes in her own concurrence. First, she says the court's evidence consisting of loosely related cases from the late 19th century and the early 20th centuries does not establish an historical analog for the names clause. So when you look back, those cases you're pulling up, Justice Thomas, they still don't apply. Second, she says, the court never explains why hunting for historical forebears on a restriction-by-restriction basis is the right way to analyze the constitutional question. Sounds like Amy Coney Barrett is not happy with this history issue either. She goes on to say this, the court does not and could not argue that the late 19th century and early 20th century names restriction tradition serves as evidence of the original meaning of the free speech clause. Wow, we've gone from this particular phrase to an invocation of the particular rule of the agency. And now we're talking about the free speech clause and Amy Coney Barrett saying the reference to history, she will have none of it. She says, nor does it treat the history it recites as a persuasive data point. Instead, she goes on to say, again, this is Amy Coney Barrett, it presents tradition itself as the constitutional argument. The late 19th century and early 20th century evidence is dispositive of the First Amendment issue. Yet, she says, what is the theoretical justification for using tradition that way? Relying exclusively on history and tradition may seem like a way of avoiding judge-made tests, but a rule-rendering tradition dispositive is itself a judge-made test. Those are strong words coming from Amy Coney Barrett. They're also embraced effectively by others on the Supreme Court, including Sonia Sotomayor, including Elena Kagan, including Ketanji Brown Jackson. And it is fascinating, not just because of the nature of this case, this intellectual property case, but it may also signal that the Supreme Court internally, when they're making reference to this adopted principle, this way now of analyzing cases, the Supreme Court may, in fact, be wrestling inside its own members with whether or not this principle articulated in the Guns case, this Bruins case, needs to be revisited. Probably they're confronting some problems in the disposition of that Rahimi case and finding that indeed, somebody who's got a domestic violence restraining order against them should not have a gun. They want to reach that result. But if you go back in history, history would suggest just the opposite. My guess, my reading these tea leaves and these very strong statements by admittedly a minority here of the Supreme Court, but a minority that is strong and articulate, suggests that this issue of looking backwards may be on the cutting room floor at some point, may get on the chopping block here. And that's the other reason why this otherwise seemingly lighthearted and silly case involving this particular phrase does have some meaning and may in fact be a predictor in some way about the other cases that are still out there. 24 more cases to be decided, including guns, including social media, including things like obstruction charges and immunity, including the emergency abortion case, and all these other matters now on the docket of the Supreme Court, coming up for decisions in the days just ahead. On this broadcast, future broadcasts of Amicus, we're going to take all those up. Join us for those discussions as we continue to...
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time when we're back in the studios of Madison celebrating our Civic Media Scotty Summer Text to Win win. Join us. All that and more review of the weekend's news. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Well, hi there. It's the fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke bringing you the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings right here on WBZH. It's not just for farmers. It's for anybody that loves food. Tune in 5 a.m. on the Buzz of the North, 910 a.m. Hayward.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.